So here we go again with another edition of Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. This time we are June 8th, 2025, at least from where I'm sitting at the moment. And we're going to be playing for you some news stories, mostly about homelessness, possibly about police misconduct, possibly about people fighting police misconduct, as well as the, around homelessness, the fight against ordinances that criminalize homeless people as cities grow bolder in their attacks on folks outside. Then we're going to go to a flashback, which is going to be happening in a couple hours if you sit through this show, to November 13th, 2005, which has lots of stuff which I'll be describing at the end of this show. And you can also find a written version of it in a few days, if you're listening to this on the 8th of June, on the Huff website, under the Huff blog, the full blog. Go there. Well, it can be a trial to sometimes find it, but it's in the first few paragraphs of the Huff website. And you can get a description of what's coming up in the flashback. So, there you are.
Tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs, they simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic, I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking, why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
And I shouldn't forget to mention that we're also going to be bringing you more from David Rovick's History of the World, according to him, his musical history. He will be picking up from 2016 or 2017 and taking it from there. You can also follow him online, History of the World, according to David Rovick's. So we're going to begin with some heavy news. Trump has signed a memo deploying 2,000 National Guardsmen to Los Angeles. As of tonight, as I prepare this netcast for the 8th, I'm actually doing it on the 7th of June, 2025. And I've been watching some of the angry crowds demanding that ICE stop its seizure of essentially non-criminal people that is creating a sort of a terror-fear response in the community, which is how it looks to me. And, of course, Trump is magnifying this with his 2,000 National Guardsmen heading for Los Angeles. Let's hear how CNN reviews it, though remember this is mainstream legacy media, so watch your step.
We have breaking news now. You are seeing protests erupting in the Los Angeles area tonight as law enforcement squares off with crowds protesting immigration raids in the city. For 2 days in a row, the LAPD has used flashbangs and tear gas to clear demonstrators. The Trump administration is deploying 2,000 National Guardsmen, a move California's governor called inflammatory. And the FBI says it will investigate protesters for interfering with federal agents. Let's get to CNN's Julia Vargas Jones now, who's with protesters who've gathered in downtown Los Angeles. And Julia, what have you seen so far?
Hi, Brian. Look, we are here outside the federal building in downtown Los Angeles, where protesters are saying, you know, they don't want ICE in Los Angeles. They're chanting, "Out with ICE, release the people that have been arrested." There are about 118 people that were arrested, according to the Department of Homeland Security. In the several actions that took place in Los Angeles this week, some of them hearing downtown Los Angeles, three of them on Friday, and then again today in about an hour south of downtown Los Angeles in the town of Paramount. That is where we saw some quite stunning video of protesters, community members stepping in and kind of stepping in the way of federal immigration officers as they were staging for a potential raid there. Brian, we are also hearing the calls for the release of, you can hear it from David Huerta, a prominent activist and union leader here in Los Angeles that was arrested as part of these raids. The National Guard, we are expecting the National Guard to arrive in Los Angeles soon after President Trump authorized about 2,000 of them to come in. Now, we also did hear from Governor Gavin Newsom, his statement saying that he thinks that this will only fan the flames of these protests, which right now are quite small, even though these images I know are striking. Not sure if we have those right now, but earlier today in Compton, just near Paramount, where these ICE presence was known earlier today, we saw a car set on fire. We could see protesters with Mexican flags setting that car on fire. That's, again, just an hour south of where we are. Just to give you that sense of how dispersed these actions are and how they are targeted, these specific locations where ICE raids are, or here where this detention center is, where some of the people that have been picked up in these raids have been brought to, Brian.
All right, Julia Vargas-Jones, I want you to stay with me. I also want to bring in now CNN senior national security analyst Julia Kayyem. Julia, if you're with me, you just heard Julia there describing the scene. But from the images that we've been putting on our air so far, what stands out to you at the moment?
So there's unrest. Let's start with there's protest. Lawful protest, which is allowed in this country. There is some unrest generally dealt with by local law enforcement, and if there needs to be state support through state police, and sometimes even National Guard under a governor's authority. What is happening tonight is unprecedented in a variety of ways. Generally, when the National Guard is federalized to be deployed into a state, so understanding that it's called Title 10 federalization, and it means that the National Guard goes from reporting to the governor to reporting to the president of the United States. Generally, historically, when that's done, there's only two instances. One is when a state is overwhelmed. And so think Hurricane Katrina. I just looked up the numbers. In Hurricane Katrina, about 7,000 National Guard were federalized. So under just the comparison to 2,000 for a couple of hundred protesters, you can just get a sense of the sort of reaction that the Trump White House is having. The second type of instance where you would see a president ignore a governor's wishes is if the governor defies a court order. So that's Little Rock, the civil rights cases in which the president federalized the National Guard to allow to support the Supreme Court's decision. Modern history hasn't seen something like this. And I think that's why Gavin Newsom and certainly our reporting from Josh Campbell regarding the concerns even in local law enforcement is now there's this federal overlay that is hostile to the sort of the way it generally works. And there's no training. We don't know what their rules of engagement are. We don't know why 2,000 have to be deployed. I'm looking at the pictures. I'm not minimizing civil unrest. Violence should not be used. It's against the law to disrupt a federal law enforcement action. But we have tools to do with this that are far less, let's just say, caustic than what Donald Trump has decided to do tonight. And I just want to put that in historical perspective. Some of our viewers will think that's right. But historically, this is not typical. And the numbers, when you just compare this to Hurricane Katrina, those of us who remember Hurricane Katrina, entire city and court system underwater, you get a sense of why Governor Newsom and local law enforcement are very concerned about what's about to happen.
I know California leaders had said that this will only inflame the situation. When you think of the historic nature of this, that this hasn't happened where there's been that transfer of power to the president from a governor since Katrina, is there any oversight for that situation in the aftermath to be able to look and say, was this done above bar? Was this legal? What's the situation there?
Well, one historical precedent is the LA riots. That was actually cooperative as well. And the after actions that I know very well, this is my space, this intersection between military, homeland, civilian, is that it was there, but for the grace of God, was there not friendly fire? Because, I mean, look, our federalized troops are trained to do something, and that something is the use of force. They are not trained to de-escalate a political situation, civil unrest. I mean, you know, the language that's being used by the White House, I'm from LA, I'm looking at people running errands. Like, this is not a city that is not able to function. And so the Trump White House has now lowered the bar. And so in terms of operational planning, we don't know how they will be deployed, what the rules of engagement are. Are they working or are they in conflict with the Los Angeles Police Department? This is a sophisticated department, quite large. And 2,000 troops, again, is a lot. This is a significant number of federalized troops. Again, that number of federalized National Guard during Hurricane Katrina, a city that had lost 2,000 people that could not function. Its courts weren't open. Its prisons weren't open. Its police force was not functional. You only saw the federalization of about 7,000 troops of the National Guard. So this is, and that was at the request of the governor. This is in defiance of a governor's request. So I do think there is a high likelihood that this will engage, incite a conflict. But my equal concern is without a sort of standard a process by which these 2,000 are deployed, rules of engagement, who are they working with? What's their mission? This is a bunch of protesters, but we know how to deal with that. I mean, in civilian society. So without editorializing, I just want to give the comparisons this is unprecedented. The numbers are large. The threat does not seem to be one in which the state has fallen apart. The city has fallen apart. If there are criminality is ongoing in terms of disrupting a federal law enforcement effort, such as an immigration raid, those people ought to be arrested. But this is, I think, part of an overall reaching by the Trump White House to utilize federal military resources in civilian society without an insurrection, without a major flood, without a major crisis, and in defiance of political leadership there. And we'll see what happens overnight.
Julia Kayyem and Julia Vargas-Jones in Los Angeles.
And here's another breaking YouTube story. It's I'm not sure how recent this is. It says 3 hours ago, and it's now around 9:30 as I do this show on Saturday evening, the 7th. This is a Brian Tyler Cohen's show. He titles it Supreme Court Drops Bombshell Ruling.
This is Democracy Watch. Mark, we have a really concerning ruling here handed down by the Supreme Court as it relates to DOGE and their access to everybody's Social Security information. Can you explain what happened here?
Yeah, you may remember when Donald Trump came into office and Elon Musk and Donald Trump were, you know, best friends at that point. One of the first things DOGE wanted was access to Social Security data. And actually, the person in charge of that data actually sort of put up a fight and wound up resigning. But ultimately, They, you know, Donald Trump put in place someone who was willing to give Doge access to this information, this highly sensitive information. I mean, we all know the risks associated with Social Security numbers and the like being shared, but that got overruled and got shared with Doge. A lawsuit was filed to try to prevent the continued access of this information and the use of this information. The lower courts actually blocked the Trump administration, saying basically, look, there's no reason why Doge needs this information, and they certainly don't need it on an emergency basis, right? We can all take a deep breath, figure out what is going on here, and then, you know, if they need access to all of it or some of it, then that can be sorted out, but that in the meantime, it should be blocked. Well, the Trump administration brought that to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it looks like by 6-3, because we know there were three dissents, that information is going to be turned over to Doge. Doge is going to be allowed to use that information while this case goes forward.
What was the Supreme Court's rationale for? Well, I understand that this is a temporary basis, that they allow this information to be shared while they rule on the merits. But even still, what was their rationale for allowing the information to be shared even in the interim?
Yeah. So look, this is something that comes up in a lot of the cases that you and I discuss. And it's actually something I wrote about on Democracy Docket going back now, you know, maybe a month or so, about this idea of a presumption of regularity. In the normal course, the courts assume that if the federal government says we need to access this information, there is a good reason for it. That if the president says, look, I think we want to make sure Department A and Department B are coordinating, that there is a good reason for it. And I'm telling you, this presumption of regularity is going to be the end of democracy if the courts don't start applying skepticism. So on the one side, in a lot of these cases, what you have is the Supreme Court, in my view, turning a blind eye to reality. What they would say is, you know, assuming the best out of and normal behavior on the part of the government, and that's the reason, right? Is that they would say, well, look, you know, why wouldn't you allow the federal government to share information that the president thinks is?
They're basically just banking off the goodwill that the federal government has built up over the course of centuries. And so even though they're not acting in good faith, they still derive a ton of benefit from the actions of the government in the past.
That's right. And that is, like I said, to me, one of the greatest threats to democracy is this idea that we're going to assume that Department of Justice lawyers tell the truth. We're going to assume that the Trump administration acts in good faith. We're going to assume that the president has the best interests of the American people at stake, when, like, none of that's true.
Well, not only is it not true, but even this Supreme Court itself has seen the ways in which the Trump administration is perfectly content to cast off any goodwill that they may have built up. I mean, this was the same Supreme Court that the Trump administration defied for the better part of a month in refusing to facilitate the return of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, even to the point where judges were discussing sanctions in the lower courts. Judge Sinis had allowed the conversation of sanctions to go through. So how is this Supreme Court so blind to the reality of what this administration does? I mean, they read the news. They have access to the same information that the rest of us do. And I get why they had paid deference to the federal government before. But we're in a new world now, and they can see what this administration is doing. And so why aren't they adapting as quickly as the lower courts seem to be?
So I think that there is a unified theory here that I have offered before and I'll offer again now. And I think this is actually a pretty good illustration of it. When it comes to the power of the president over his administration, the Supreme Court puts on blinders. You know, it goes back to its like, you know, let Donald Trump run the federal government how he wants to run the federal government.
Yeah.
It is only in those instances where it is the presidency versus the courts, right? Where there is a claim that the courts don't have a role. I mean, after all, really, if you think about the cases involving immigration, what's really gotten the court upset where they have acted boldly has been the suggestion that there is no due process, which is another way of saying that the courts don't get a say.
Right.
So in some ways, that's the exception to the rule, not the rule. And sometimes I think people in the center and in the center left and on the left get overly excited when they see the Supreme Court, you know, seemingly reining Trump in. But you always need to ask yourself, are they just reining him in versus John Roberts' power, or are they actually protecting other parts of the government? And when it comes to protecting other parts of the government, I mean, we've seen the Supreme Court allow the firing of heads of independent agencies and access of data and the like.
And so I don't want to bury the lead here because I know everyone watching has the same question, but what does this mean for Social Security numbers? What does this mean for any of this personal private information that was accessed or that can be accessed now by the team at DOJ?
So look, I want to put another layer on that, which of course we have seen the great falling out between Donald Trump and Elon Musk. And so the question about what does it mean, I think, becomes a little more dire, right? Because, you know, it was bad enough and pretty bad that, you know, people's Social Security data and tax data and payment, remember there was also payment data, like we've seen this now in a lot of places, that was going to be accessed by, you know, these folks hired by Elon Musk and DOJ and the like to rummage around the federal government. But what does it mean now that there is a falling out between the two? And who the hell knows which side Big Balls is on, right? I mean, like, he's now, you know, he's still, as I understand it from reading the newspaper, he's still now a government employee. But is he part of sort of Team MAGA Trump, or is he part of, you know, the Elon Musk faction? And I don't even know there is an Elon Musk faction, but as someone who has personal data at the federal government, I certainly don't want there to be warring factions who have access to data.
Yeah. And so is this a situation where, I mean, where folks should be worried? Is this something that we'll have full insight into at some point in the future? And is there some risk in the fact that this team of people who was associated with Elon Musk also, you know, look, Elon has companies that would certainly benefit from having some of this personal private information floating around.
Yeah, absolutely. And Donald Trump's administration may have reason to take actions against people who have connections with, right? I mean, like, it cuts in all different ways. I mean, this is just not the way the federal government's supposed to work. Right. So should you be worried? Yeah. I mean, you should be concerned whenever you have a federal government that is, you know, run across between cronyism and incompetence. And certainly when it involves your personal data and information, you should be worried. Will we ever get to the bottom of it? I suspect at some point we'll get to the bottom of it, but there could be a lot of damage done along the way. You know, there could be damage done to individuals. There could be damage done to systems. There could be damage done to the payment systems that millions of recipients of Social Security rely on. We see what the Republicans in Congress are up to with Medicaid. It's not a huge jump to jump from Medicaid to Medicare, from Medicare to Social Security. You know, like, this is both the gang that couldn't shoot it straight, but also the gang that doesn't have very good intentions when trying to shoot.
Right. And finally, let's finish off with this. We had mentioned that this is allowed on a temporary basis, on an interim basis, while they litigate the merits of this case. And so what does that look like in terms of when we can expect some type of resolution? Obviously, there's some urgency in this case in particular because it deals with our Social Security information. And so when do you expect we'll have some final resolution where the Supreme Court actually rules on the merits?
Yeah, so look, there's going to be a fair amount more process here because what the Supreme Court did was actually send the case back down to the trial court, you know, it removed. So this case is going to be going on a while. There's also, by the way, another Supreme Court ruling that came out involving DOJ that also on Friday that involves the question of whether DOJ is even a federal agency. Now, that was a records case, a case about, you know, FOIA and whether there could be discovery into how DOJ operates. But think about it, Brian. Think about the sort of the absolute bizarro world we live in which, on the one hand, the Supreme Court is issuing an order that says, yes, DOJ, because it's part of this federal government and the president wants it, gets access to your data. On the other hand, there is a case going on in which the federal government is disputing in part whether DOJ is even a agency subject to FOIA. Like, it's like there just is no consistency to what the Department of Justice and the federal government will argue in some of these cases. And it is amazing that you would have the Supreme Court on one day both sort of inside insulate Doge from discovery and at the same time, you know, allow this to go forward.
Yeah, well, never underestimate Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. With that said, all of the information that I've been learning as I keep up with this case, I've taken from Democracy Docket, which is the YouTube channel that you started. You've been talking about this issue and every other issue at length. So highly recommend for everybody who's watching right now, if you are not yet subscribed to Democracy Docket, which is Mark's YouTube channel, please go ahead and hit the subscribe button. Doesn't cost you anything to do that, but it helps elevate his voice, which is especially important right now. I'll put the link right here on the screen and also in the post description of this video. I'm Brian Tyler Cohen.
I'm Mark Elias.
This is Democracy Watch.
And related to federalization of the National Guard, protests against ICE, seizures of folks who have lived here for years, but Trump fulfilling his campaign pledge of not just running out criminals, with people with criminal records, but anybody who is technically in violation of immigration orders or immigration laws, which is, what, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. Anyway, here's a story, I should say a song and a commentary by David Rovics, in which he begins with a description, the Trump administration institutes child separation policy on the U.S.-Mexican border. Name of the song is ICE.
For the latter half of 2017, and especially during the first half of 2018, the Trump administration was actively separating children from their parents when families of refugees were crossing the Mexico-U.S. border. Thousands of families were affected. Thousands of children and parents traumatized forever. Some have never been reunited.
She left late at night, out of sight of the gangs, the most violent place in the West. Just the clothes on her back to escape the attack, with one child held to her breast. 4 weeks they would go through Mexico, where Rosita and so many others would learn too late that the United States takes babies away from their mothers. When Rosita was younger, the future looked brighter, but then came 2009. A junta, a coup, and prospects were few as the bodies were stacked up in lines. She tried to stay, but there was no way when they kidnapped and tortured her brother. So she got to the border where they're following orders to take babies away from their mothers. Gunmen were always so near. She knew she had to push on, make it to Houston, where she might live a life without fear. Their journey was done. Rosita, her son, at the border, they held one another. Oh, how he wailed as they took her to jail and tore him from the arms of his mother. Late at night, out of sight of the gangs, the most violent place in the West. Just the clothes on her back to escape the attack, with one child held to her breast.
And back to what may seem to be the ongoing protests in the Los Angeles area, resisting ICE seizure of folks who have worked for years in the United States, have families here, and are now suddenly being ripped from where they are and dumped without particularly court hearing or warrant into, well, God knows where. But people are resisting that. And as you've heard from the audio of the earlier newscast that I played, here's another one from KCAL News. Again, this is a bit more, you might say, right-wing or conservative, legacy media, some would call it. And its headline is from KCAL News. President Trump orders deployment of National Guard as protests escalate in Los Angeles.
Breaking news, a car goes up in flames right in front of Dale's Donuts as protests in Paramount get out of control and spill into Compton. And tensions escalate, officers in riot gear firing tear gas at protesters who are pushing back on immigration raids. Then people throwing stuff and banging on Border Patrol cars as they pass through crowds. Meanwhile, another crowd tries to block a U.S. Marshals Service bus. Federal law enforcement officers use tear gas and flashbangs to clear away the crowd. Tonight, U.S. Attorney Bill Saley says federal agents arrested over a dozen people who impeded agents. Let's get right to KCAL News reporter Zach Boetto live in Compton. Zach, what's happening? What are you seeing right now?
Hey, Gio, we're standing just off camera here. To our left, there are some masked people who have just bashed and tipped over this solar security camera station that was set up here at the ARCO gas station across the street from where the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department deputies are stationed. Over here to the right, you can see those deputies. They have riot shields. They're standing strong at the intersection of Alondra and Atlantic. They're trying to hold there and make sure that the protesters don't go past that point. As you mentioned earlier, let's roll some video. There was a car that caught fire at the intersection here of Alondra and Atlantic, just right in the middle of the intersection where traffic was going back and forth and where authorities were trying to push protesters away from the action. We've seen fireworks. We've seen flags out here, people on dirt bikes, people on motorcycles. You've seen spin-outs, burnouts, donuts, pretty much anything that you can think happens in a major protest we're seeing right now here in Compton. We did speak with the Los Angeles County Sheriff, as well as a protester, about what's happening here in Los Angeles today. Here's what they had to say. Well, we'll get to that sound.
This is a United States of America. It's supposed to be for everybody. No one's better. No one's superior. We are the same. We bleed the same. We will die the same. We will all go under the earth the same.
All we're doing is trying to help our people from being separated from their families. That's all we're doing. That's all. Do you see anybody being violent right now, sir? No.
As the crowd has grown, it has become more violent. Individuals in the crowd that have been throwing objects at the federal agents, and we started to call in additional resources from around the county of Los Angeles.
Now, just within the last few minutes here, authorities have opened up traffic here at Alondra and Atlantic. So that's why you can see cars now going through the intersection where that charred car still sits. Also within the last few minutes, those protesters knocking over that security camera, it's now resting on the power line just here above our heads. So a lot of stuff still happening here, Gio, in Compton, and with the federal authorities deploying more backup. We're thinking that this is not the end of what's happening here in Compton this evening.
Zach, yeah, we're seeing the knocked over station there sitting on its side from SkyCal. Before we let you go, I know earlier when we first broke in around 5 o'clock, you made a mention of how there's a large number of people there, obviously a lot of them with their phones out and other forms of a video trying to just watch what's going on. Do you still get the sense that that's really sort of the energy level of folks around there right now? Because we've described it throughout the afternoon that this is an ebbs and flows, and we seem to be on a bit of a downswing right now, but we know that that can change at any moment.
Yeah, Gio, I would say about 90% of the protesters that are here have their phones out and are observing what's happening. There's another 10%, and the sheriff said maybe 300 to 400 protesters here, so maybe about 30 to 40 people who are causing a lot of the damage, who are responsible for tossing over this security camera station, who are doing the burnouts, who are lighting cars on fire, lighting fireworks, but still a very active scene. And like you said, it ebbs and flows here. We just saw, I would say, the deputies here, the number of Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies double within the last 15 minutes. So we're here. KCAL's on scene. We're watching. We're reporting. We're talking to protesters. We're talking to the sheriff. And as everything plays out here this evening, we'll be here to make sure our viewers know what's happening.
Absolutely. Zach Boetta, live in Compton. Zach, thank you. And breaking news, Governor Newsom says that President Trump is moving to deploy the California National Guard. The National Guard is controlled by the governor, but Governor Newsom says the federal government is moving to take over the California National Guard and deploy 2,000 soldiers. Newsom goes on to say that move is purposefully inflammatory and will only escalate tensions. And President Trump posting this on Truth Social, saying, quote, "If Governor Gavin Newsom of California and Mayor Karen Bass of Los Angeles can't do their jobs, which everyone knows they can't, then the federal government will step in and solve the problem. Riots and looters the way it should be solved." Earlier, not far from the Compton scene in Paramount, protesters clashed with law enforcement, with protesters trying to block vehicles and throwing objects at cars. Officers using pepper spray and firing rubber bullets. Take a listen to this. And just before officers used tear gas and rubber bullets, protesters tried to block a U.S. Marshal bus from driving through the crowd. See the horn honking, the face-to-face between the bus and the protesters, not to mention the flashbangs going off in the background. And this is another moment captured on camera. Protesters going face-to-face with a law enforcement vehicle and throwing what looked to be milk and other objects at a U.S. Customs and Border Patrol vehicle. And over in Inglewood, citizen video shows someone being stuffed inside a Border Patrol car. A few people were outside of the car protesting law enforcement. It's unclear if this was part of a larger raid or who the person was being taken. We've reached out to federal officials but haven't heard back yet. Today's protests come after an hours-long demonstration in downtown L.A. yesterday. People crowded the federal building where detainees were taken following widespread immigration sweeps in L.A. The protests got tense at times, with officers firing tear gas to clear the crowd. And that protest continued into the night, with crowds gathering in Chinatown, where federal agents appeared to be staging. Protesters confronted those agents as several flashbang grenades went off. Several of the armored vehicles were also vandalized with graffiti. And the leader of one of the nation's largest labor unions remains in federal custody. Service Workers Union President David Huerta is accused of interfering with the LA immigration raids. The U.S. attorney says Huerta was blocking an ICE detention van. The union says Huerta was injured during the arrest and had to be taken to the hospital. Huerta is expected in court on Monday. Today, California lawmakers say they are being denied entry into the downtown L.A. detention center where detained migrants are being held. Congressman Jimmy Gomez and other elected leaders say they should be allowed to visit any facility that's detaining migrants, but were told they weren't allowed in because of safety issues.
I've been to the Middle East. I've been to war zones. So I know what it's like to actually be in a situation that's a lot more dangerous than inside this building.
How many people are there? It is our job as members of Congress to provide, to have oversight.
We reached out to Border Patrol for more information about the facility, but have not heard back. In a warning from the FBI, the agency says protesters could be prosecuted for attacking officers or impeding on immigration operations.
Let's take you back out live here from SkyCal in Compton. You see sheriff's deputies on the move, a couple with those non-lethals up, getting ready. Who's to say what they're about to do, but this is sort of the tense situation that we're continuing to monitor in Compton right now. A line of sheriff's deputies and multiple vehicles just behind them at the intersection there of Alondra and Atlantic. We'll keep an eye on that as the evening progresses. Of course, stay with KCAL News for developments on these protests and immigration raids across Southern California. We'll have a live update for you in just about 20 minutes at 6:30.
And now getting back to subjects I normally spend a lot more time on, here's a story by Bob McCloskey. Fresno homeless ordinance conflicts with state model. You may remember, regular listeners or just people have had their eyes on the criminalization of homeless people throughout the state. Fresno has passed an anti-homeless camping ordinance last fall. And there was some controversy because they also attempted to strengthen it or make it much more explicit by saying that anybody who helps homeless people can also be accused as accessories to the crime of homeless people camping, for example. And then this additionally was complicated by Governor Gavin Newsom's releasing a state model ordinance, which you're now going to hear about from Bob McCloskey, who writes for the Community Alliance newspaper, which is what this article comes from. This is June 2025 issue. On May 12th, Governor Gavin Newsom released a state model ordinance for, quote, cities and counties to immediately address homeless encampments with urgency and dignity. The governor's office said the ordinance will be provided to every community as a starting point so jurisdictions can create their own policies. And you might think, ah, well, perhaps they want to establish a more decent structures so people who can't get into shelters or find housing can find some way to be more safely protected from the elements, have decent basic privacy, maybe some more toilet facilities, water so that they can stay clean, shower structures, that sort of thing. No, you'd be wrong, of course. These things, which to some extent appeared spottily during COVID times a couple years back, were all removed once the COVID crisis, as it was phrased by governments, was gone. Now you have this. Governor Newsom's model ordinance contains key provisions which may be modified based on local need. This is a quote, I presume, from Newsom, including a prohibition on persistent camping in one location, a prohibition on encampments that block free passage on sidewalks, a requirement that local officials provide notice and make every reasonable effort to identify and offer shelter prior to clearing an encampment. Of course, in Santa Cruz, as most of us know, there is completely inadequate shelter, although there more efforts have been made in recent years than, I don't know, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago, but mainly because courts have ruled that you can't arrest people for sleeping or camping unless you have some alternatives. So cities have to apparently provide some kind of alternatives. But what they do is they provide the appearance without the substance of alternatives. But the basic motivation in Santa Cruz and elsewhere is still drive them out of sight or out of town. At least that's what I've been observing, and that's my conclusion after watching and getting reports from folks who are outside. And here's more on Newsom's ordinances. The ordinances help to ensure that local communities take a balanced approach to address and prevent encampments with compassion and care. See, they don't want to say with cruelty and callousness, because though that would be accurate, it doesn't really sell well with liberal folks who are putting up millions of dollars to give to through their taxes, through appropriations, but don't have much to do with eliminating homelessness, simply with hiring more bureaucrats, social workers, and creating more employees in shelters that don't provide really more services that are really accessible and desired by homeless folks outside. Continuing, the ordinance reflects the guidance for local governments created following the governor's executive order requiring at least 48 hours notice, outreach to local service providers, and proper storage of items when addressing encampments. Not the case in Santa Cruz or other places as far as I've heard, but always claimed to be the case wherever you go. Fresno has already implemented an ordinance that includes some of these suggested elements in the state's ordinance, but includes citing and arresting unhoused individuals. This is not a balanced approach, as stated in Newsom's suggested ordinance. More than 400 people have been arrested under Fresno's ordinance to date, making life even more difficult and harder for unhoused community members to ever get housing. Fresno also fails to make every reasonable effort to identify and offer shelter prior to a sweep, quote unquote. In addition, instead of offering to store property, as documented by advocates, the Fresno Police Department's Homeless Assistance Response Team throws property away on many occasions. An additional $3.3 billion in Proposition 1 funding will be provided to local governments to implement the governor's proposed ordinance. Critics say he has failed to track and audit spending of prior allocated homelessness funding. An April 10, 2024 article by Marisa Kendall in Cal Matters, titled "California Fails to Track Its Homelessness Spending or Results," a new audit says, quote, states that Governor Gavin Newsom is facing criticism for a perceived lack of accountability in how state homelessness funding is spent and managed. Yep. A recent state audit found that California has failed to consistently track the $24 billion it has spent on homelessness programs. And Newsom has vetoed legislation that would have required more rigorous monitoring and reporting. This has led to concerns about the effectiveness of the programs and how taxpayer dollars are being utilized. And I would also add more resentment against homeless people. And lots of new excuses such as, oh, these are service-resistant people. They're being offered wonderful accommodations, and they're turning them down, when what they're really being told is, pick up two bags of your stuff, leave the rest, and you'll never see it again. Go into a so-called navigation center that will claim to be navigating you toward housing, but will essentially dump you on the sidewalk in 6 months with only those two bags you started with, and perhaps not even that. The campsite that you had set up, the community that you were a part of, is now dispersed, and your chances are even worse than when you went in before. Critics are questioning whether the new $3.3 billion in funding will be tracked and audited. The funding comes from the narrowly passed 2024 Proposition 1, much touted by Santa Cruz Mayor Fred Keeley, by the way, which changed current behavioral health funding allocations to implement the California CARE, Community Assistance Recovery and Empowerment, court program, which is designed to force unhoused individuals suffering from behavioral health issues into treatment. See how tough we are. Opponents to the proposition and the CARE court cite the potential for increased involuntary treatment to infringe on individual rights. Opponents also say that forced treatment can be ineffective and might even be associated with negative outcomes, such as higher suicide risks. Critics also argue that the shift in funding priorities would lead to cuts in other crucial mental health services, such as outpatient care, peer counseling, and prevention programs. However controversial, the CARE Court program is being implemented, and the governor's new funding allocations and the implementation of a uniform ordinance statewide are the beginning of the process. Although the governor is putting a positive spin on this new effort to, quote, eradicate homelessness, or at least its visible appearance, critics continue to argue for proven solutions, a housing-first approach, services when needed, and the ending of the criminalization of our fellow human beings that suffer on the streets of California. Although many people in Fresno and across the United States lack empathy and compassion for unhoused community members, people should at least be interested in the effective use of tax dollars. The $24 billion and now another $3.3 billion in state tax dollars to provide temporary solutions instead of permanent housing calls into question the sanity of our elected leaders and the general public. California cities and counties are wasting huge amounts of tax dollars to criminalize and marginalize unhoused Californians instead of providing low-cost housing and housing subsidies for the poor. And that's Bob McCloskey, Fresno Homeless Ordinance Conflicts with State Model, June 2025 Community Alliance newspaper. And here's another one from David Rovics. He introduces this with the sentence, Willem van Spronson dies in an effort to prevent refugees from being deported in Tacoma, Washington. The song is The Time to Act.
Many people have made comparisons between the rise of Hitler and the rise of Trump. There are many parallels. Both cases begin with an economic crisis, a failure of left-of-center governing authorities to deal with the crisis in a way that allowed the working class to prosper, and the tendency of those very authorities to throw their lot in with the fascists, if the possible alternative being considered by the population might be socialism. After the defeat of what the Marxists sometimes call bourgeois democracy by the forces of National Socialism in Germany, as with the rise of Trump in the USA, there are those who still must resist, even if their cause seems to be one that is lost for the time being. In Germany, during Hitler's rule, there are an estimated 20,000 people who engaged in actions that were sure to end in their deaths, and were also extremely unlikely to result in the defeat of the Third Reich. But some people just had to do something, and so since that time, and for some people for a long time to come, the white rose will always mean something more profound than it did before it became the icon of a doomed resistance. Willem van Spronson was one American who felt he had to take some kind of action and couldn't just stand by while watching refugees get mass deported back to war zones. In July of 2019, he took action and was killed for it.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people, this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person
person do when the time to act is now?
And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
All right, well, I'm on the line with Wes White, who is a video journalist, activist, and all around. I would have to call you an optimist in spite of any growly tone in your voice at different points. You're en route somewhere, of course, as we talk, and probably violating the law by talking to me on the phone, but perhaps not.
It's on my hand.
Very good. All right. Well, as long as you're following the law, Wes. Where are you headed? What are you doing? And clue us in on your most recent activities.
About a dozen friends of mine got knocked out from what straddles Caltrans and city jurisdiction on Tuesday, and then they got knocked out again on Friday. So I've been trying to support them with some like a stove, a one burner stove, and some propane gas. And then I just dropped off a tent, but there's like 12 people, you know, so there are a lot of people wishing they had a tent. But I can only get what I get and what people are willing to give me. So I also gave them some spy cameras, so that way they can catch the unprofessional, curse-laden interactions of the police. To them, get your shit and get the fuck out of here. You know, that would be good to capture.
Where are these folks located, Wes?
They are in Salinas. They're kind of a remnant off our Sherwood Park chapter. A few people that never got in. But they're still family, and they've been all connected and held on to each other for the longest. They're still out there. So that's why I'm thinking, like, this would be a good group to support, because, you know, I mean, they're lucid, they're intelligent, articulate. And they're not the stereotype that's being looked for.
Now, how would you describe the change, if anything, that has happened in Salinas since the overturning of the Grants Pass / Martin versus Boise protections that homeless folks were somewhat entitled to or somewhat respected in last summer? So it's been about a year now. How would you describe the change, if any, in the circumstances?
Well, it's been brutal, and it's probably gone from worse to even worse. I mean, in April 23, they knocked everybody off the sidewalks to only be on the train tracks, which meant UP, Union Pacific Railroad, and Union Pacific just started, like, taking people's stuff, like, three times a week they'd come. And of course, the city's happy because it's not their expense, you know? The city has always been cruel, especially once California reopened. And then the governor's thing shortly after the court case. It's been brutal, and now even more so that our fraud five are in charge.
Well, what about your friends on the shitty council of Salinas?
My friends have been replaced with the Fraud Five.
The Fraud Five is your new epithet for the local Salinas City Council?
Yes, the five new members that got on were paid $1.6 million. That's a third of a million of a candidate. And you better believe they're bought and paid for just the same way as your real estate moguls are.
Huh. And have you been addressing this Fraud Five at all, or have you been?
They're full of fraud. Absolutely, I've already called them names.
And I mean, are you? What I'm really asking is, are you expending your energy and time on these clowns? And if so, how would you describe what consequences have come? I mean, not so much necessarily from them, as I sort of assume nothing has. But you, on the other hand, there's an audience in the chambers when you're talking. There are television crews presumably covering this. People hear about what you're doing and send you $50,000 donations and so forth.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah. Yes. I'll take it.
And of course, there's the group you belong to, and actually helped to restart the National Onion of the Union of the Homeless, I believe it's called. And they, you know, that they in fact have had some successes, both in Santa Cruz, in Salinas early on, and in Sacramento, in Nevada, in Sausalito, and in San Rafael. I mean, different places.
Chico.
Go ahead.
I'm just saying Vallejo and Chico as well.
Thank you. In fact, if you know of any of their more recent successes, bring me up to speed.
Okay, well, Vallejo is one of the most recent. Is a gal, an elder gal. She was holding down a corner property. She used camera and assisted the city in some theft. So they allowed to stay there until they didn't. And then they got a restraint order and blocked it from being evicted.
And so there's still an encampment in Vallejo that survives?
Yeah, it's just basically a one-lady operation, though.
I see. And how many people would you estimate? I was going to ask you this about Salinas, but of course I'm also interested in Vallejo. Vallejo is it about the same size as Salinas, or are they different?
Oh, much smaller.
So Vallejo is much. How big is Salinas, would you say?
Salinas, I mean, they say 150, 200.
And your estimate, and I know it's always these estimates are uncertain, but your estimate of the unhoused population in Salinas is what?
I think our number says 1,100 or 1,300.
And how many of these would you say are, does that include people who are rotating in and out of so-called shelters or not?
No.
So they're
out. If they're in a program, they're in a program. If they're outside, they're outside.
I see. Now, in a program, in Salinas means what?
There's a navigation center, there's a share center, and Victory Mission. But Victory Mission would probably still count, you know. But if you're in a mission, you probably don't have a tent either. So, they're counted by encampments they can find.
So, do you have connections with the folks that are in these different programs as well, or are you pretty much, you do?
Tell me. As in participants or administration?
Participants, although you can tell me about your connections with the high mucky mucks as well, if you have any.
Right, or just frontline workers.
Yeah, right on. I'm not sure frontline in what way. These are people who are paid salaries to come and supposedly advise people on how to get into housing that doesn't exist.
Right, yeah, front-facing. How's that?
Front-facing, okay. But with their asses lagging behind, perhaps.
Maybe their pants are over their face.
Masks would be, of course, appropriate in some situations. So Salinas has, about a 1% homeless population, you'd say?
That sounds reasonable, yes.
And about 10 years ago or so, actually a little less, you were working with Attorney Anthony Prince and a lot of other homeless people and some council members to at least maintain an encampment at City Hall called the Flag Community, and also,
Flagpole.
Sorry, say again.
The Flagpole.
Flagpole Community. Thank you. Yes, and also, I guess we're working on trying to restrain the anti-homeless criminalization forces, which are ever busy at work. Have you? I have a variety of questions that's coming to mind. One of them is, are there any individuals from that period who you still maintain connections with and who have been, if not active, at least on reserve that you ever consult with or come to the protests and organizational meetings that you have, if you ever have any such things?
Well, most people who have, graduated, like actually been served and got housing. A lot of people moved on. They grew, and this was a crisis. It wasn't like their life's journey. So it's hard to get people to come know, and I'm fine with that. I would rather see them be successful and lead their own life and be happy. If they do come back, that's twice as well, you know. But most of the people that I know have you know, moved on and graduated, you know.
Mm-hmm.
From 10 years ago, hardly anybody. I mean, I think there's still a couple people in the Sheriff Center, and that's been a couple of years at least, probably since 2020. You know, and that was certainly a gripe. They sold themselves as, oh, we'll flip the whole population or our whole 100-person set in like 3 to 6 months. And, of course, that didn't happen. After a year, they got half the people out. So, you know, but everything's always been a sales pitch. In fact, the jurisdictions know it when they sign it.
Well, let me get back to this question I asked you before for Salinas. How have things specifically changed? I guess you were going through the description of how people were driven from pillar to post or from sidewalks to Union Pacific, and Union Pacific stepping up its actions after the Supreme Court's decision last summer.
Yeah, well, that was actually in April of 23. I think the Supreme Court case was 24.
That's correct.
And Newsom's, you know, in like 2 or 3 weeks after that. So yeah, you're right. It's already been a year since the governor's order. But California reopened 23, June of 23. And Salinas went after it, you know, in April. They started hitting it. But before that, we had porta potties and dumpsters and hand washing stations. CDC guidelines until they decided they weren't going to support any camps at all. And they'd rather just rip you off.
And this, I know you spent a couple of years, we've talked about, I've been, you know, lashing you into the post for, you know, your conversations and hopes and dreams for incoming council members that you'd support or new committees of council members who were on the council.
Stop short on purpose.
Sorry, say that again.
I said, yes, they did stop short on purpose. You know, that nobody would say stop the sweeps and a couple of the council members that are out now, which
They're no doubt rushing with you to mobilize against the sweeps, right?
Yeah, no, I tried. They mobilized for rental stabilization protections, which Santa Cruz wished would have happened.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Another song by David Rovics, Land Day. He introduces by saying, "The Great March of Return begins in Palestine on Land Day in 2018.
Palestinians have been losing more and more of their land to Israeli theft since they lost the majority of it in 1948. In 1976, Palestinians protested against the theft of yet more of their land, and for doing so, they were massacred. This protest massacre became known as Land Day, one of many massacres on the Palestinian calendar that have been marked by annual protests ever since. In 2018, at the end of March, beginning with Land Day, Palestinians protesting under the banner of the Great March of Return rallied at the fence between Gaza and Israel, and they were shot at and killed by Israeli soldiers. Another Land Day massacre. Undeterred, they returned the next Friday, and every Friday for the rest of 2018 and well into 2019. The weekly massacres were global headlines for a couple of Fridays. Then, as a massacre of Palestinian children became a weekly Friday feature of reality, it stopped being a news story in the Western media.
Another day, another massacre of children. Children who have nothing good to show since their families became refugees so many years ago. When Zionists had launched their latest annexation, which awakened the resistance of the Palestinian nation. And they called it Land Day. For the day the land was stolen by the new crusaders. For the day the land was stolen by the new crusaders. Another day, another massacre of children. with traumatized survivors of Nazi genocide, killing traumatized survivors across a new divide, a divide that was created by killing kids and taking land with a twisted kind of logic only death can understand. And they called it Land Day, for the day the land was stolen by the new crusaders. The land was stolen by the new crusaders. Another day, another massacre of children. Children they call terrorists for throwing stones at tanks. Children they imprison for refusing to give thanks for the fact that no one is running gas chambers quite yet, though it's hard to see how much more like a death camp this can get. Called it Land Day, for the day the land was stolen by the new crusaders. For the day the land was stolen by the new crusaders. Another day, another massacre of children.
So did, would you say, and this is, I guess, a more complex question, but it's certainly related, has the change, if any, in renter protection in Salinas impacted the number of homeless people in your view as far as, and I don't just mean theoretically, I mean based on your observations, because you've been here looking at this one pretty closely.
It's been growing. The population is growing. Even the city of Salinas has missed that.
But would you say that the rental... renter protections have had any impact on any of this?
Well, I mean, they've hardly had a chance to perform. They were only installed in January, and the city has not a real clear direction, so they've had hardly any effort put into it either.
And what would
because
you say?
They're expecting it to die, so why put any energy into that?
What are those protections in theory? And
well, there's a rental registration. Registry, you know, so property owners say how many units they have, and if they're filled, you know, then that way, when somebody does have a complaint, they, you know, they're in their system. There's an unjust evictions, tenant protections, anti-harassment, and then rent stabilization. So four different ordinances.
So the unjust eviction, how has that improved life for tenants there, would you say?
Well, I mean, if there's an eye, if Bigger Brother is watching you and telling you don't do that, you know, you have a tendency to adhere to that. But if Big Brother is saying, I don't care what you do, then, you know, they're going to adhere to that. So, it has rolled back some things. You know, as far as harassment, you know, and but yet now in the last couple months, they're like, yeah, that thing's gonna get overturned, and I can't wait to charge you more, and you know, I guess just being more belligerent. The landlords are you know, there's I think it's about 18% of the entire housing rental market or whatever available is pre-95, you know, so it has to be Casa Hawkins. Appropriated, so no new construction after 95 can be rent stabilized. But anything before 1995 is in there.
Huh.
So that's been a contention. You know, 2.75 of your rent, you know, if you're paying 2,000, that's, I can't even say. But that's kind of all is getting bumped up, you know. Or if it's 1,000, then it would bump up to 1,027, right?
So it's only, you say it's 27%.
2.75%. So if you're paying $1,000 in rent, your rent would go up by $27.50. Now, if it's going up 10%, then it's going up $100.
So are you saying that are the landlords respecting these limits, as far as you know?
Yeah, because it's the law.
Well, you would think so, but in order to enforce the law, you need both lawyers and judges who are willing to enforce the law. Do you have those in Salinas?
Well, there was a case that they thought was going to hit the rent stabilization, but it really didn't. It was a sidestep. But, you know, and the property manager of 36 North, you know, like actually recorded the court proceeding and gave it to a bunch of city officials in defense of why she said it was unconstitutional, even though it wasn't. And say, well, here's the proof. I recorded the meeting, the court hearing, which is illegal. And if I would have done that and said I did that, I would have got straight arrested. But apparently she's not in trouble.
Well, of course, I believe that such illegalities is, of course, against the interests of the public, whether it's landlord or tenant. I think you should be able to record any fucking thing you want. In fact, you should.
Absolutely. No, the Constitution goes out the window once you first walk in there and the sign says you can't record. That's the First Amendment oppression.
Right. Well, that's frequently why I used to ignore when walking into the police station. I observed such things. I said, yeah, right. What, you know, blow me, so to speak.
Right.
You know.
Well, I mean, but I'm just saying, in a normal situation for me, if I was to do such a thing, I would be completely, immediately consequenced, no questions asked, just snatched right out of my chair.
Mm.
Well, but since she's rich and she's actually pushing the agenda of rich, then it's okay, and we'll just overlook it and forget.
Now, when this person did this, this pro-landlord person, in an attempt to, delegitimize...
To say that the rent stabilization was unconstitutional.
Now,
did
this have any effect upon the foul four, or whatever we're calling them?
The fraud. Fraud.
Fraud, yeah, fraud four. Okay, fine. Fraud five. Ah, that's true. Good point, yes. So, did that have any effect on these five?
What did what have an effect?
You know, did they decide to change the law to remove unjust eviction protections, or to remove rent stabilization, or the other two items you mentioned? What were the other two?
Well, they had already decided that like a couple months before that.
So they have.
They just did the second reading of repealing the rent stabilization, tenant protections, unjust eviction, and one more. So they just did a second reading on that on Tuesday, and now we're trying to file a referendum, gather enough signatures. In fact, I meant to go by there today, but I got this wasn't the way I planned my day. But I meant to get some signature gathering paperwork from them today, but I could not.
So, have you? Well, you were saying you actually have been spending the day delivering necessary items to people who are trying to survive outside, right?
Yes, part of the day. I saw Rita today and Pamela Weston, which was really cool. She blasted from the past, but she's foundational to starting the homeless union. And she was just here for, you know, a weekend. And so we ate lunch and talked about, you know, well, what are we going to do? How do we strengthen this homeless union chapter, I guess? And she's talking about, you know, using the law and doing claims. And I already did the claim. You know, I gave out 10 claims to folks. I don't know if it's going to be enough or even if anyone's going to fill it out. But that's the beginning of a lawsuit. You do a claim, it gets rejected, and then you can file damages.
And what are you proposing that people sue in order to claim? What tort or what wrong are they? Are we talking about a civil lawsuit, or trying to beg the prosecution to do a criminal prosecution?
That's a good question. I'm not positive because I'm not an attorney.
Right. Well, yeah, it's not. Just for future reference, it's not really a big deal. Civil lawsuits have to do with, you have to show damages of some kind. You get an injunction to stop them from removing a campsite. You show that the removal of a campsite has produced loss of property and, you know, injuries of different kinds and loss of things. I don't know, you know, the police behavior has hurt people's mobility and so forth. The other usually involves, criminal prosecution involves, they have to violate some kind of law that, whether it damages people or not, they're violating the law and they need to be prosecuted. That's much harder to do, particularly since prosecutors usually win by, election victories. And these days, the tougher you are on the poor, the better, that sort of thing. So
it's more profitable that way.
You certainly get more donations from people who are afraid of that sort of thing. I think mistakenly afraid in the ultimate sense. But so you, how large was this encampment that you said about eight to twelve people? Something
like that? People, yeah.
And do they have a name? Would you call them anything?
Oh my. No. I mean. They're remnants of our Sherwood Park Union chapter, we've been using locations as a name, but they have to float too much. So I don't know. Have they come up with a name? No, they have not. They're just family.
And they are simply like a minor drop in the bucket of the 1,000 plus people who are outside in Salinas, right?
Right, yeah, just only one encampment from one neighborhood, yes.
And are you in touch with any of the other encampments, or is that pretty much your contact?
I'm in touch with folks. It's hard to keep form a bond with. That community has been obliterated a long time ago.
Which community are you talking about?
Any encampment. People stay together until they're forced apart. And whether they come back or not, may or may not happen.
True. So, are there still places where people are gathering other than this one encampment?
Like Sanborn Bridge, okay? They've been out for 50, 60 people, and only five people come back. So where do the other 50 people go? I don't know. Further down the tracks, to Rossi or something. I don't know, dude. But they're gone. How do I find them again? Ouch. Yeah, good question.
Well, I guess it's a mutual activity. Do you have any way people can locate you?
I pass out my card all the time.
And do you get any response, do you think?
Well, lately, from folks from lately, yes. They asked me for, I gave them a spy camera. I gave them four or five spy cameras. And that was on the Tuesday, and then they got knocked out on the Friday. But the three people I gave it to weren't there, and they didn't leave it behind. So nobody got the real big drama. And since nobody got it, everyone is hungry for the cops to come back. Because they already know the cops are going to be assholes. Well, let's show the point then, prove it. And then maybe we can force a policy change.
So
by the way, they understand.
So you put cameras in the hands of some people today.
I didn't hear you.
You put cameras in the hands of some folks today.
Yes. Yesterday, actually.
And have you... You've done this before.
Typically, that is the point of my phone to call me, and I'll show up like Batman to record the bastards. But I can't be instant, so that's why give the body cams.
And Rovix introduces the next song by saying, "2-year-old refugee Mauda Sean is killed by police in Belgium." The song is called "Mauda Was Her Name."
On May 17th, 2018, I happened to be in Belgium, and all the talk locally was about what happened on the highway to Antwerp. A van packed with refugees was on its way to the port, from where people were hoping to get to England. Cops were suspicious of the van and tried to pull it over, but the driver wouldn't stop. Rather than using any number of other means to stop the van, the police inexplicably decided to shoot at it with live ammunition. Equally inexplicably, they were aiming for the driver. If they had succeeded in hitting the driver, the consequences for everyone else in the van
could have been catastrophic. As it was, the bullet missed the driver and hit the 2-year-old girl, who was sitting on her mother's lap in the back seat, Mauda Shaori. Mauda represents part of the trend with refugees in Europe, who are increasingly dying in their efforts to get from France or Belgium to England.
Their country was invaded and destroyed. Then they had a baby boy. They sold everything they owned so they might escape the war zone. They took the Baltic route, north and west. It was the one the smuggler said was best. They got as far as Germany, which is where they had another baby. It's a deadly thing, what some call immigration. England was their final destination. In a crowded van, driving to the port, on past Flanders fields, another life cut short. Cops on every side, the vehicle surrounded. When the loud crack sounded, Mama held her daughter tight in place. Then she saw the bullet hit her face. And Mauda was her name. Mauda was her name. There are many ways to stop a van, many ways to do it. They can make a roadblock, for one. If you're under fire, you can use your gun. But all the bullets flew in one direction. At first they denied it, but at closer inspection, the cop was aiming for the driver's head. But he missed and hit the girl instead. And Mauda was her name. Mauda was her name. If the driver had been hit, how many more? Numbers would be added to the score. Of those who only wanted to raise a family, but then died on the shores of Turkey, or somewhere in the desert, or tortured in a prison, or on the bottom of the ocean, at a Baghdad checkpoint, or at a traffic stop, or shot down by a Belgian cop. Mauda was her name. Mauda was her name. Mauda was her name.
Have any of these folks who in your encampment, the one we're talking about, got a phone or that is operational for them?
They do, but, you know, the phone is for phoning. And, that's hard enough to keep charged. So if they keep this side pocket on the charge already and just only use it for, police, then it's always ready.
So are they able to...
One guy said that they were really careful to make sure that everything's charged. Because, like I said, they're ready for it. They're ready to catch the police doing wrong. And whether or not they'll get in trouble, who gets themselves in trouble? Why do you have to get yourself in trouble?
So
I did nothing wrong.
You used to have a group who would kind of go with you to different places, whether it was, the Pajaro River encampments and other groups in other places, who would be witnesses to police behavior, who would be supportive of people.
Actually, the Watsonville's crew is their own crew, who would legally observe, and the three that they got arrested with me. That solidarity of folks they know, their own family, you know?
Right. But what I'm wondering is, are there any people who remain in the Salinas area that are part of that kind of group for you?
Salinas is very shy. Nobody really wants to step out of line. Nobody wants to even be considered not being cookie cutter. So no, it's very limited. I try to do cop watch. There are a couple guys that do cop watch, but they're not like sweep oriented, you know? They just want to test the police's reaction to being in a public space.
To test it or to document police abuses?
Yes.
Do they have an organizational name or?
No, but one is Community Watch 831. His name's Frank Evans. Dang it, I don't know Jeffrey Stillwell's handle. And then there's another one, Anthony X, or Judo Johnny. And they just basically got their own channel.
And have you spent much? You have much connection with them?
They don't really care about sweeps.
Uh huh.
They care about testing the police interactions in public space.
By test.
So they'll go to mental health. And no, I don't. I don't run the same circle they do.
Uh huh. So there's not much exchange between those folks and you. I got you. So
we've gotten the cop things. Like AB 482, the one for all your damaging gear. What are you doing with it? You know, drones and ballistics and all this other shit. They got, you know, and they have to give a report annually. But I haven't really seen them too much lately. Although I shared one video about one homie getting nut checked, and that guy gave away his rights. That's what hurt the worst. Mm-hmm. He didn't have to ID. He didn't have to give over an ID. He didn't have to answer questions. He didn't have to consent to a search.
So I should mention that you are a lot of what you do is not just distributing survival material, and I regard video camera as a kind of survival material to folks who are outside, but you also you have a YouTube channel, John Doe 13K YouTube, which you have been posting on for the last decade, right?
Yes.
And this is for various community services, but you also initially, didn't you begin this as a sort of a, or maybe I'm wrong, maybe you just sort of worked into it, a homeless civil rights sort of thing or not?
Yeah, I mean, how it started for me was a principal was getting fired for unjust reason, but since she's at will, that's all that mattered. I showed up to talk about my kids, my situation, my kid's mom and how she lied, and then found out, oh, that had nothing to do with it. They just want to get rid of the principal, and they did. And I watched them do it at 11:30 at night after they said they tabled the item and then brought it back after all the parents went home. I said, dude, that's pretty shiesty. Noticed it at City Council, followed them for about a year about finances, you know, on the agenda, how they're misspending money, and then storage of personal property on city property after a year. And, you know, that's, but I was recording since the school district. So June of 2014, and then started following City Council about October 2014, and then September of 2015 is when that storage of personal property on city property came about.
And clarify that phrase, storage of personal property on city property.
Well, that's the ordinance where they said anything bulky or soiled was meant to be trashed.
And you and Anthony Prince and others successfully torpedoed that ordinance, correct?
Yes. No, the city wrote a new ordinance with administrative procedures 1-7 that they never intended to follow, but showed the judge, and the judge signed off on it saying, okay, you're going to be a good boy now.
And this new ordinance is actually currently active?
No, it's from 2016.
Right, but that doesn't matter. It's currently active, right?
Everything on the books are currently active.
Well, what I'm saying is it? Do you find that if anybody is, if some homeless person went to recover his property, have you gotten any reports on, yeah, I went there and they wouldn't let me in, I went there and they gave me half of what I had, they went there and arrested me again?
The city does not collect anybody's possessions anymore, so they don't collect anything for anybody to get back.
Was this a change in policy?
Yes, of course. They decided they weren't going to do it anymore, and they never did. And fighting it is expensive and overwhelming, and I could not keep up.
And about what time did this begin to change?
Probably in 2017.
Hmm. So
yeah, storage. You know what they would do is do the storage. You know, and then they'd have to have space for it all. And that's what really frustrated them, because a lot of people never came back. And then they made the rule that if you do come back, you got to take it all in one trip, which made it near impossible for anybody to do that. So, and then they just decided they're just not going to store anybody's stuff anymore. Let's go back to be lazy, you know? And who's going to fight it? I mean, yeah, I'm overwhelmed, dude. I cannot be the only one.
Wes, we always get into this. I'm never suggesting you ever be the one. What I'm saying is, you, in a sense, many of people who are in your position, and I've seen myself, you know, in earlier times as being this way, you blaze a trail, and you see, this is where, you know, you might want to go if you're dealing with this shit, you know, in the years ahead. But, the fact is, if it's on the books, it is available for some eager beaver to try and say, hey, state law says, and city ordinances say, where they could actually trap city officials with this, you know, with this kind of thing, and then sue them. So that can happen too. So that's why I keep asking when I say it's active, and I hear your rage and frustration when you say.
I'd love to go at it. It's just
And I'm not saying you should go. Wait a minute. I ain't saying you should do anything other than what you're doing. I'm saying this can be done by someone in the future, and that's why I ask these questions, because if there is such an ordinance, they'll need to know what the ordinance is, they'll need to know what the state law is, and the more experience they understand of the people who've gone before, and the history of how the city has changed its policies, can be helpful to them, particularly if it involves, ultimately, lawsuits that have the city worried about shit, and the public worried about budget deficits and all that kind of crap. So
yeah, that's why I don't scare them like
well, you're not expected to scare them. You are one person, and you're engaging in doing pretty much trying to hold a number of leaks and dikes that you are probably should be trying to hold less leaks.
I did a lot of guerrilla stuff too. I mean, I hung out at people's camps and waited for the cops to show up. Got them like that. So I mean, you know, ambush reporting, I've not done that in a long ass time.
Right.
I could become quite a target, you know, of retaliation.
Well, maybe you should write a book on it, or some guidelines on that for folks who are, you know, just getting into this, who are outraged if they may have friends who have been abused by the police who live outside, and they might want to pick up on it, or just, you know, it's like people who are looking at the Gaza murders that are going on as we speak right now, today, tomorrow, and the next day. And they finally start saying, oh, I guess it might be genocide. In other words, that kind of thing is happening for numerous, at least, media figures in throughout the country, and I would say throughout the world, to some extent, at least.
Hey, I think they're starting my thing. I gotta go, dude.
Oh, okay. Right. Well, listen, try again. I mean, we'll try again. Bye. And thank you, man.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, writes Rovix, is forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy and imprisoned in Belmarsh prison. Here's the song, Behind These Prison Walls.
In April of 2019,
Julian Assange was violently abducted from the Ecuadorian embassy by British police and taken to the maximum security Belmarsh prison, where he'd remain for years before his eventual surprise release. The U.S. was pursuing charges that might have resulted in a 175-year prison sentence. The U.S. authorities were clear that what Assange and WikiLeaks had done was help expose U.S. war crimes in Iraq, and for that, someone had to be punished. For many years, Assange expected to be arrested and expected these charges to be leveled by the U.S. The governments of the U.S., the U.K., Ecuador, under its new right-wing leadership, and Sweden all put a lot of time and effort into trying to ruin Julian Assange's reputation in a very complex smear campaign involving allegations related to sexual impropriety as well as allegations of being a Russian agent of some kind. The campaign to destroy Julian Assange's reputation, as well as to destroy him mentally and physically through years of imprisonment and various forms of torture, was so involved and multifaceted that anyone hoping to understand it all basically needed to read a book. Nils Meltzer, longtime UN rapporteur on torture and human rights, wrote that book, thankfully. But before anyone picks up a book like that, they probably first need to have a solid suspicion that there's something more to this smear campaign than meets the eye. They need to have a suspicion that, in fact, they're lying, and they're lying about a man who has done more in the service of humanity in his lifetime, arguably, than just about anyone. I wrote the song, essentially, in the hope that people might pick up the book.
Prison walls, there's a man who's won awards for the work that he has done and all that it affords, such as the knowledge of the horrors committed in our name. They can't stop the message, so the messenger gets blamed. Behind these prison walls, in solitary confinement, in a land of rolling hills and royalty and other such refinement, is someone who is a hero to whistleblowers everywhere, who helped them tell the world of the crimes of Tony Blair. Behind these prison walls, you will find a mortal man. The reason why we know what happened in Afghanistan, when the soldiers of the Empire, whose sunset long before, were torturing civilians in their terror war. Behind these prison walls is a part of WikiLeaks, an eloquent orator, but you won't hear him speak. Locked away in silence, one who knows too well how those in power act when there's another war to sell. Behind these prison walls is one who stands accused of exactly what offenses the U.S. has refused to say precisely which, or to try to clear the mist
or to explain how he's not the same as other journalists behind these prison walls. Is a person they deprive of most of the things in life that keep us all alive. A person being tortured as we stand here now for revealing the war crimes. Why, when, where, how? Behind these prison walls, our very right to be informed of what the hell is going on. Is the teacup in this storm? With knowledge there is power, so the solution by the crown. A 24-hour a day indefinite lockdown. Behind these prison walls,
the global corporate press, with the very active and insidious involvement of the government of Sweden at various levels, and many other institutions to boot, was working hard to associate the name of Julian Assange in the public consciousness with sexual impropriety of one kind or another. When Assange was moved from the Ecuadorian embassy to Belmarsh prison in 2019, his partner, Stella, went public with the fact that she existed as such, and that she and Julian had managed to have two children, in secret, while Julian was in what became a bizarre form of house arrest at the Ecuadorian embassy. She hoped in revealing herself and their little boys to the world, this might help counteract the smear campaign. In writing this song about how they met, my hope was to contribute to this effort a little bit as well.
Stella in the embassy, in the only room for 7 years that he would ever see, guarded by police with cops on every street. An unusual situation for the first time you should meet. When Julian met Stella, the time they spent was increasingly within the walls of a little tent, where they could have some privacy from the ever-present gaze under which he was spending all his nights and days. When Julian met Stella, there was the chance of grace. Perhaps the president would decide to drop the case. They had two children beneath the watchful eyes of the Americans and British and all kinds of other spies. When Julian met Stella on Embassy Row, it was before he was abducted and forced to go to Belmarsh prison without a chance to speak, awaiting the extradition that the USA seeks. At the UN and people all around the world spoke out then. This journalist belongs among the free, not in prison for exposing crimes against humanity. When Julian met Stella.
And that was When Julian Met Stella. And here's a story from the San Francisco Chronicle of June 6th, 2025, front page story. Homeless Oakland man has lived on land for 8 years now. He's suing over a civil code dealing with abandoned property, battling eviction from a vacant lot. And there's a picture of Mike Bowen, 60, leaning against a covered car outside his home on an East 12th Street encampment in Oakland. Bowen, who says he's lived on the lot for the past 8 years, is facing eviction. It's a story by Anna Bauman. A ball cap shading his eyes from the morning sun, Michael Bowen took stock of his surroundings. An elevated shack he built with tarps and wooden planks. A garden with potted succulents and a plum tree. And stacks of the rusted scrap metal he recycles for income. 8 years ago, Bowen moved onto an unusual wedge of vacant land near Interstate 880 in Oakland, in Oakland's Fruitvale neighborhood, which he thought had no owner. He established a small encampment where he lived with several friends and more than a dozen cats as BART trains rumbled overhead. For a long while, no one seemed to mind that he claimed the spot. But Bowen, 60, and his community will probably soon be displaced from their roadside settlement as the owner, the City of Oakland, it turns out, moves to reclaim the land to accommodate a Pacific Gas and Electric Company construction project. Officials plan to evict the occupants next week, despite an attempt by Bowen to challenge his forced removal in federal court. "They want to take away my home, my livelihood," Bowen said in an interview Monday from the property at the corner of East 12th Street and 23rd Avenue. "That would leave me sitting on a bus bench waiting on that list of temporary housing, and God knows how long that will take." On May 23rd, the City of Oakland posted a notice to vacate the, quote, illegal encampment, unquote, ordering the occupants to leave the site and remove all vehicles and other belongings before Tuesday, June 3rd. "The City of Oakland has deemed this site uninhabitable," the notice said. "Vehicles left at the site will be towed. Personal property left at the site will be removed and stored or discarded pursuant to the City of Oakland storage procedures." In response, Bowen filed a lawsuit last week against Oakland City Administrators and Mayor Barbara Lee at the U.S. District Court in San Francisco, arguing that the encampment closure would violate his civil rights. Bowen, representing himself in court, also argued that he had the right to live on the property under a California civil code that deals with abandoned property. "By virtue of my occupancy, I am the presumed owner of the property," Bowen wrote in court filings, noting that he settled on the lot because he believed it was a no man's land. A sign hanging from the front gate of the encampment makes a similar claim. "Private property, no trespassing." Lawyers for the City of Oakland, however, said the encampment falls inside a public right-of-way, meaning the land is subject to city control and is not available land that can be claimed by anyone encamped in the area, according to court records. During a hearing Monday afternoon, Judge William Orrick indicated he would probably side with the city. "Even though you've been on the property for a long time and have taken steps to show your possession of it, you can't get adverse possession for property that is on a public right-of-way," Orrick said. "You don't get to claim it as yours." Orrick ruled against Bowen in a Tuesday order, but delayed the encampment closure by a week, giving occupants until Monday before Oakland can sweep the spot. The city scheduled the encampment closure in response to a request from PG&E, which wants to replace a utility pole on a parcel of land adjacent to the encampment, according to the court filings. The infrastructure upgrade project is critical for improving power distribution and supporting the increased load demands of our operations, the PG&E representative wrote in a letter to the city. "The removal of the unhoused encampment is essential to facilitate safe access and efficient completion of the work." A spokesperson for the City of Oakland confirmed the encampment was being closed to enable PG&E to complete, quote, critical work. PG&E did not respond to a request for comment. This was not the first time Oakland had has tried to clear the encampment, or that Bowen has pushed back. 2 years after Bowen settled on the property, in February 2019, city officials posted a notice to vacate. Bowen filed a civil rights lawsuit, making similar claims about his right to occupy the land. But the city let the eviction notice expire without attempting to remove the camp, saying in court filings only that, quote, the reason for eviction had changed and it no longer intended to vacate the encampment. The inaction rendered the lawsuit moot, according to the city, and a federal judge eventually dismissed the case. This month's impending closure comes as Oakland has taken a more aggressive approach to addressing a growing homeless population. The city has cleared several major encampments in recent months, including a large and long-standing encampment on East 13th Street, just three blocks from Bowen's encampment. Outreach workers engaged with occupants there for more than a year ahead of the closure and provided 70 people with interim housing at a former hotel purchased with state and local funding grants, according to the city. Six more people were housed through a medical respite care program. Bowen said he has seen people sleeping at bus stops every night since the encampment closure. Others displaced from the large East 12th Street camp migrated several blocks to join Bowen inside his gated encampment, where several motorhomes are clustered amid collected junk. The city isn't providing enough shelter. They don't have enough shelter for all the homeless people in Oakland, said Tom Jensen, a 78-year-old homeless resident in Oakland who is friends with Bowen and lives nearby. The city comes in, destroys their camps, destroys everything, and puts it in the trash. And then all they're doing is moving people around and causing a lot of oppression of people. Bowen, originally from Portland, Oregon, has lived in Oakland for more than two decades and became homeless 9 years after, 9 years ago after a fire at his last residence. Bowen said he used to work in construction and property management. Now he says he walks the streets collecting scrap metal and does odd jobs at nearby houses, developing relationships with his neighbors. He wanted to start a nonprofit organization offering free showers and laundry to the homeless, but after suffering a stroke last year, Bowen said he's just trying to stay alive. With the encampment sweep looming, Bowen said he is worried the city will ruin his garden and take his belongings, including a BMW sedan that he bought after months of saving and piles of recyclables that he trades in for money. But his top concern is for his cats. He feeds them all and refers to them by name as they dart through his encampment like kids on a playground. If I gotta leave, I don't know what I'm gonna do. I'd love to have housing, Bowen said, but he added, I don't want to get rid of my cats. That's a story in the June 6th San Francisco Chronicle. Homeless Oakland man has lived on land 8 years. Now he's suing over civil code, dealing with abandoned property, battling eviction from a vacant lot by Anna Bowman.
By 2019, the housing crisis in America had reached astounding proportions, though in the years afterwards, it only got much worse. A visit from the United Nations to Los Angeles drew comparisons to the worst refugee camps that lack the most basic facilities. By 2019, the numbers of people dying on the streets of Portland, Oregon were approaching an annual count of over 100. In Los Angeles County, the number of annual deaths of people living on the sidewalks or the streets exceeded 1,000 for the first time.
It's 2019. Looking around at the tents and trash and excrement scattered on the ground. So many mansions overlooking the sea.
stretch limos, Rolls Royces, and movie stars all over Los Angeles County. It's 2019. And one thing I know is most people wish we could rewind to a couple of decades ago, before the rents tripled, folk began to move out into their cars, into their tents, where drivers look on however loudly you shout. It's 2019. But in a black and white photo, it could be 1929, wherever you go. In every single neighborhood, hungry people wonder why some make billions on a blockbuster while so many are left out to die. It's 2019, where every 8 hours someone is found cold on the sidewalk beneath the glass and steel towers in the wealthiest nation in all of human history. So far from paradise, so close to Walt Disney. It's 2019. There's no Dust Bowl, just real estate speculators and all the lives they stole. I don't know what to think when I hear the reporter say 1,000 people died last year living on the streets of LA. It's 2019.
And now comes the flashback, which is actually longer than the contemporary show. It's a flashback to November 13th, 2005. It begins at more or less usual commentary from Bathrob Spear, which is me, and Jason Pascal, African-American fortune teller who showed up on the streets of Santa Cruz and received particular attention from then Sergeant Butchie Baker, Lauren Baker, also known as Sticky Fingers Butchie among the homeless, or some of us anyway, for his reported harassment of, what, 9 or 10 women in 1992 or thereabouts, or at least it was reported and became a scandal at that point before it was white-papered over by the police department, the DA's office, and some state agencies. Then you have Crossroads Chris Brozda, sometimes known as Crosswires Chris because of his outspokenness, who talks about his struggle to maintain his own dignity and sanity in Dominican Hospital, and not just in Dominican Hospital, but being persecuted for his outspoken political opinions on the left. We have Stanley Mays, 11 of 17 months in county jail, and the irrepressible and often annoying Madison, a very frequent caller on this particular edition of Bathrob Spear's Broadsides. More from the world of psychiatric madness with, again, the institutions, in my view, being more insane and more abusive than the individuals that they are supposedly trying to, quote, help. That's Zoran, who talks about his adventures in Lodi psych wards. Bear, also known as, I think it's Ted Fleming, not sure, weighs in. Marion Fisher, an old poetess and late 80s homeless activist, shows up again in 2005 in this edition. Becky Johnson presents her view of the indie media controversy, where a number of indie media individuals, that's a website that covered a lot of, well, I did a lot of writing for them about the issues, about homeless issues, and Becky did too, but her pro-Zionist, as I saw them, views on Israel alienated them rather severely, and her behaviors prompted her exclusion. I should say that was the basis of a controversy that you'll hear more about if you listen to this particular edition. Different people call in about it, including Theodore Carey, who's a sort of a seminal figure in fighting for the rights of medical marijuana, as well as, other social issues, but that was the one I was most aware of with respect to her. Gregarious Gregory, also known as Rhodes Scholar, sounds the warning about the midnight legislation being proposed by, as he describes it, controlling street musicians or restricting them. John Rappaport, known on the street as Hot Rod, talks about his 8-infraction trial. And in the same courtroom corridors, Leatherling's Jim Purcell weighs in. John Teal King talks about other leftist doings. Then you can walk with me down memory lane at the Red Church, which was a constant, a regular feature of my Monday evenings. I would go there, record people standing in the chow line about what happened to them in the last week or so. Sue, I think she was called String Stroker Sue, who played, I felt, rather badly on Pacific Avenue, but who was also quite articulate about what she saw there. The Office of Compassionate Use was something presented by the City Council as its bone thrown to the medical marijuana people without actually expanding real access to medical marijuana for middle-class people and poor people, but patting the back of and riding the back of WAM, Women and Men for Medical Marijuana. And finally, Becky Johnson chimes in from the Nickelodeon protest against the Resource Center for Nonviolence, which I think had something to do with her views around the what would now perhaps be called pro-genocidal Israeli behavior, but she would probably have regarded it as simply self-defense for Israel. But that's a sort of a standard Zionist position that is wrong and in error, in my view, to put it mildly. It's a pretty packed episode, 3.5 hours long, more or less, thereabouts. And it's there for you to hear if you'd like. If you want to get in touch with me, and this is what I often say at the end of these netcasts, please call me, 831-423-4833. That's the Huff line. Show up at a Huff meeting, which has been meeting and generally rumbles on every Thursday, 1:30 to 3:30, at the Sub Rosa Cafe. That's at 703 Pacific, right next to the Bike Church in downtown Santa Cruz. See you there, perhaps, or get in touch with me if you've got stuff you want to put on the air here, or on the net, I should say, or on the archives, and keep your eyes out, as ever, on the street, because it's your eyes and your voice that actually means something in these days when the media is looking the other way, whether it's from Gaza or from the oppression of homeless people in Santa Cruz.